64. Entered cities first. In the big room, they were dancing to a record player, one of the new console type. The Makarigans had a cabinet full of records. There were the speeches of their father and friend, mumbling and droning with his Georgian accent. No home could be called well supplied without them, though normal people, the Makarigans included, never listened to them. There were songs about our own, our beloved leader, and songs in which airplanes came first, while girls took second place, though listening to them here would have been as improper as speaking seriously of biblical miracles in a pre-revolutionary drawing room. The records in fashion now were imported, but not to be found in the shops and never broadcast by Soviet radio. They even included songs sung by the émigré Leschenko. The furniture took up too much room for all the couples to dance at once, so they took turns. The young people present included girls who had been Clara's classmates, a man from their class whose job now was jamming foreign broadcasts, the girl, a relative of the prosecutor, who was responsible for Shchakov's presence, a nephew of the prosecutor's wife, a lieutenant in the internal security troops whom everybody called a frontier guard because of his green piping. His company was, in fact, attached to the Belarusian station in Moscow to inspect passengers' documents on trains and carry out arrests that proved necessary en route. One young man, a statesmanlike figure with smooth, already thinning hair, stood out from all the rest. He already had the Order of Lenin, but wore just the ribbon without the medal itself, carelessly or carefully pinned slantwise. This young man was 24 or so, but his comportment, the restrained movements of his hands, the gravely pursed lips, was intended to make him look at least 30. He was one of the highly valued consultants employed by the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, and his main job was drafting speeches to be delivered by deputies at future sessions. The young man found this work extremely boring, but his prospects were of the brightest. Getting him to attend her party was in itself a triumph for Alevtina Nikanorovna, and marrying him to Clara was her wildest dream. To the young man himself, the only interesting thing about the party was the presence of Golakov and his wife. He had danced 3 times with Dinera. In her long black dress of imported silk, she seemed to be sheathed in shiny black leather, with only her smooth, white forearms showing. Flattered by the responsiveness of such a famous woman, the young man grew bolder and tried to detain her after they had danced. She, however, had spotted Sonkin Golovanov, who did not dance and was at ease nowhere outside his editorial office, sitting in the corner of a sofa. She made straight for this square head, mounted on a square body. The young consultant glided after her.
"Eric," she cried, "why didn't I see you at the premiere of 1919?
Golovanov brightened.
"Went last night," he said,
and moved up to make more room on the sofa, although he was at the very end already. Dinera sat. The consultant sat down beside her. If Dinera felt like an argument, it was hopeless trying to avoid it. Indeed, you'd be lucky if she let you get a word in edgewise. She was the subject of an epigram of sorts, current in Moscow literary circles.
"Oh, how I enjoy my silent hours with you! I have to, for you never let me speak."
With no literary position and no party office to inhibit her, Dinera boldly, but never overstepping the mark, attacked playwrights, scriptwriters, and producers, not sparing even her own husband. Her daring judgments, together with the daring way she dressed and her daring past, which everybody knew about, made her very attractive and agreeably enlivened the vapid judgments of timid literary officeholders. She attacked literary critics in general, and the articles of Ernst Golovanov in particular. Golovanov showed forbearance and tirelessly alerted Dinera to her anarchistic errors and petit bourgeois backslidings. He was happy to keep up this humorous pretense of friendly enmity. His literary future depended on Golakov.
"Do you remember," said Dinera,
striking a dreamy pose for which the hard back of the sofa proved too uncomfortable,
"do you remember in another of Vishnevsky's plays, an optimistic tragedy, that chorus of 2 sailors. One says, 'Isn't there too much blood in this tragedy?' And the other says, 'No more than in Shakespeare.' Now that's what I call clever. So So you go to this new Vishnyovsky play all agog. And what do you get? It's realistic enough, of course, and the portrayal of the leader is impressive, but what else can you say?
What more do you want? The consultant protested.
I don't remember ever seeing such a moving representation of Iosif Vissarionovich. Many people in the audience shed tears.
I had tears in my eyes, too, Dinero retorted.
That's not what I'm talking about.
She turned to Golovanov again.
Hardly anybody in the play has a name. The dramatis personae are all faceless. 3 party secretaries, 7 senior officers, 4 commissars. It's like the minutes of a meeting. And yet again, brief glimpses of the little brothers. Those sailors forever on the move, from Belotirkovsky to Lavrinyov, from Lavrinyov to Vishnyovsky, from Vishnyovsky to Sabelyov.
Dinero emphasized each name with a blink and a toss of the head.
You know from the start which are the goodies and which are the baddies, and how it will all end.
Well, what's wrong with that? Golovanov asked in amazement. He livened up when he was talking shop. He looked like a hound following a good scent.
Why do you always want the unreal but superficially entertaining? Is life really like that? In real life, did our fathers ever doubt how the Civil War would end? Did we ourselves ever doubt how the Fatherland War would end, even when the enemy was on the outskirts of Moscow? And is a playwright ever in doubt how his play will be received? Explain to me, Eric, why first nights in Moscow are never a flop? Why don't playwrights live in dread of a first night flop? Honestly, I won't be able to stop myself one of these days. I will put my fingers in my mouth and give such a whistle.
She mimed it prettily, though it was obvious that no whistle would result.
Certainly, I'll explain,
Golovanov said, unperturbed.
Plays in our country do not and cannot fail, because playwright and public are in harmony both on the artistic and ideological level.
This was too boring. The consultant straightened his yellow and blue tie once, straightened it again, and rose to leave them. One of Clara's classmates, a thin, amiable girl, had been quite openly eyeing him all evening, and he decided to dance with her, a two-step. Then one of the Bashkir maids started carrying ice cream around. 2 chairs had been pushed into the narrow space in front of the balcony door. The consultant steered his partner toward them, sat her down, and complimented her on her dancing. She smiled encouragement and began chattering. The budding statesman had come across willing females often enough, but had not yet tired of them. This girl, now, all he need do was tell her where and when to turn up. He eyed her slender neck, her still unripe breasts, and, taking advantage of the fact that curtains partly concealed them from the room, graciously captured the hand that lay on her knee. She began talking excitedly.
Such luck meeting you here like this, Vitaly Yevgenievich. Don't be angry with me for troubling you off duty. Only I could never get past reception at the Supreme Soviet.
Vitaly removed his hand from hers.
Your secretariat has had papers from the camp about my father for 6 months now. He's had a stroke, and he's still there, paralyzed, and I'm petitioning for a pardon.
Vitaly leaned back helplessly in his chair and dug his spoon into the ball of ice cream. The girl had forgotten hers. Her hand clumsily brushed against the spoon, which somersaulted, left a spot on her dress, and fell by the balcony door. She let it lie.
His right side is completely paralyzed. If he has another stroke, he'll die, and he hasn't got long to live anyway. Why keep him in prison any longer?
The consultant looked sour.
It isn't very tactful of you to approach me here, you know. Our office number isn't secret. Call me there, and I'll make an appointment. What is your father in for, anyway? Article 58? No, certainly not,
the girl exclaimed with relief.
You surely don't think I'd dare ask you if he were a political offender? He was sentenced under the law of August 7th.
It comes to the same thing. Remission has also been abolished for people sentenced under the law of August 7th.
But that's horrible. He'll die in that camp. Why keep a terminally sick man in prison?
The consultant looked her straight in the eye.
If we take that line, what will be left of the whole legal code?
He grinned.
After all, He was duly tried and found guilty. Just think, what if he does die in the camp? People die in camps just like anywhere else. When the time comes, what does it matter where anybody dies?
He got up in annoyance and walked away. The glass door to the balcony looked out on the restlessness of the Kaluga Road. Headlights, car horns sounding warnings, traffic lights flashing red, yellow, green under the steadily falling snow. The girl, without tact, picked up her spoon, put down her cup, crossed the room quietly, unnoticed both by Clara and by the hostess, went through the dining room where tea and cakes were being gotten ready, put her street things on in the hallway, and made for the door. Galachov, Innocenti, and Dutnara stood aside as the despondent girl passed through the dining room. Golovanov, in high spirits after his talk with Dinera, greeted his patron with his old playfulness.
"Nikolai Arkadyevich, stop. Confess now. In the bottommost depths of your soul you are not a writer, but what?"
This sounded like a repetition of Innocenti's question, and Galachov looked embarrassed.
"A soldier, that's what?"
Galachov smiled bravely.
"Yes, of course. I'm a soldier."
He screwed up his eyes like a man staring into the distance. Not even the most triumphant day in his career as a writer had left such proud memories, or, more important, such a feeling of purity as the day when he had impulsively taken off in a reckless endeavour to reach the headquarters of a half-surrounded battalion, landed in a raging storm of heavy artillery and mortar fire, and later that evening eaten out of the same mess tin as the three officers of the battalion staff, in a dugout shaken by gunfire, and felt himself the equal of those hard-baked warriors.
"So allow me to present my army friend, Captain Shchakov."
Shchakov stood erect, refusing to lower himself by a show of respect for a superior. He was pleasantly tipsy. He had drunk just enough not to feel the pressure of his feet on the floor. And as he had become more relaxed, his present surroundings had become more manageable, more welcoming. The bright, warm room, the luxurious carpeting and solid furniture that spoke of assured affluence. Amelia he had entered with his nagging wounds and unslaked hunger merely to reconnoitre, but that promised to become his future. Shchakov had been feeling ashamed of his modest decorations in this company, where a beardless boy wore the ribbon of the Order of Lenin pinned casually askew. But as soon as the famous writer saw those campaign medals and the two wound stripes, he swung his hand at Shchakov's and shook it heartily.
"Major Galachov," he said, smiling, "which front were you on? Come and sit down and tell me about it."
They moved to the settee, making Innocenti and Dotty move up. They invited Ernst to join them, but he made a sign and disappeared, rightly assuming that this meeting of old warriors should not be a dry occasion. Shchakov told them how he and Golovanov had become friends in Poland one mad day in 1944, September the 5th, when Soviet troops had broken through to the Nadiev, and their impetus had carried them over the river, fording it on planks almost, because they knew that it was easy enough on the first day, but on the second they wouldn't have a dog's chance. They had cheekily pushed their way through the Germans along a corridor no more than a kilometre wide, and the Germans had tried to cut them off, throwing in 300 tanks from the north and 200 from the south. As soon as they began exchanging wartime memories, Shchakov forgot the language he used every day in the university, and Galachov forgot not only the language of publishing houses and writers' committees, but even more completely the carefully calculated and controlled idiom in which books are written. It was impossible to convey the full-blooded drama, the smoky tang of life at the front in those well-worn, smoothly polished literary locutions. Before they had spoken a dozen words, they felt a desperate need for oaths that were quite unthinkable in that place. Golovanov reappeared with three glasses and a half-empty bottle of cognac. He moved a chair up so that he could see both of them, and filled the three glasses.
"To soldiers' friendship," Galachov said, screwing up his eyes. "To those who didn't come back," was Shchakov's toast.
They drank. The empty bottle went behind the settee.
Golovanov steered the conversation his own way. He told them how, on that memorable day, he, a newly-fledged war correspondent 2 months out of the university, had travelled to a forward position for the first time, got a ride on a truck, carrying anti-tank mines to Shchakov,
and sped from Dlugosledla to Kabat along a corridor so narrow that the northern Germans were lobbing mortar bombs onto the southern German positions, and how, on that same day, one Soviet general, returning to the front from home leave, drove straight into the German lines in his jeep. That was the end of him. Innocenti had been listening, and he asked them what the fear of death felt like. Golovanov, in full flow, answered promptly that at such desperate moments you don't fear death. You simply don't think about it. Shchakov raised his eyebrows and demurred. You aren't afraid of death until you really get shaken up. I was never afraid of anything until I experienced that. I got in the way of a heavy air raid, and for some time after, I was afraid of bombs and nothing else. Then I got shell-shocked and became afraid of artillery. People say you needn't be afraid of the whistling bullet. Of course not. The one you hear isn't meant for you. You won't hear the one that kills you. Death needn't really concern you. While you exist, death doesn't. When death comes, you're no more. They had put Baby Come Back to Me on the record player. Shchakov's and Golovanov's reminiscences did not interest Golachov. He had not witnessed the operation they were talking about. He did not know Dlugosledla and Kabat, and, what was more, he had not been a small-time correspondent like Golovanov, but a strategic commentator. Battles, in his mind, did not take place around a rotten plank bridge or a shattered water tower. His was the wider vision, the field marshal's view of the overall logic of events. So Golachov gave the conversation a new twist. War, war, war. We go into it ridiculous civilians and come back with hearts of bronze. Eric, did they sing the song of the frontline correspondents in your sector? Didn't they, though? Nyera, Golachov called out. Come over here, Nyera. Come and help us sing the frontline correspondent song. Dinero came closer, nodding eagerly.
Whatever you say, my friends. I was a frontline girl myself.
They turned the record player off and began singing, the three of them. What they lacked as musicians, they made up for in sincerity. From Moscow to the border, we advance in battle order. An audience gathered around them. The younger guests stared curiously at Golachov. You didn't meet a celebrity like him every day. From vodka and rough weather, our throats are like cracked leather, but we'll thank you kindly not to say a word. The moment they began singing, Shchakov went cold inside. He kept on smiling, but he felt guilty toward those who could not be present, those who had swallowed the waters of the Dnieper back in 1941, or taken a mouthful of Novgorod pine needles in 1942. These wordsmiths didn't really know the front line, which they had now turned into a holy place. There was an unbridgeable gulf between even the most daring of war correspondents and the frontline soldier. A gulf as wide as that between an aristocrat who cultivated his land and a peasant ploughman. War correspondents were not tied by service regulations and officers' orders to the immediate business of fighting, so nobody could call it treason if they showed fright, refused to lay down their lives, and fled from the battle zone. Hence the psychological gulf that yawned between the frontline soldier, whose legs had taken root in some outpost, who had no escape and might die right there, and the war correspondent who had wings and who could be back in his Moscow apartment the day after tomorrow. And anyway, where did they get all that vodka that made them so hoarse? From the CNC's ration? A soldier got 200 or as little as 150 grams before going into an attack. In the places where they sent us, no tanks were ever lent us. If a newsman should get killed, then never mind. In a worn-out Moskvich roadster, armed with an empty holster, we entered cities first and the rest behind. This entered first referred to two or three anecdotal occasions when war correspondents who couldn't read a relief map properly rushed along a good road, a Moskvich couldn't manage a bad one, landed in some town in no man's land, and tore out again like scalded cats back the way they had come. Innocenti listened, head down, and found a meaning of his own in the song. He knew nothing at all about war, but he did know about Soviet newspapermen. Your Soviet reporter was not the hard-done-by character celebrated in these verses. He did not lose his job for missing a scoop. He had only to show his press card, and he was treated like a person in authority, someone entitled to issue directives. The information he obtained might be correct or incorrect. He might send it to his paper in good time or with some delay. His career did not depend on that, but on ideological correctness. A correspondent with a correct worldview had no real need to rush off to some hellhole in the battle zone. He could write his dispatches just as well behind the lines. Dottie's hand had closed around her husband's wrist, and she sat quietly beside him, content neither to speak nor to understand the clever talk. This was her most delightful habit. She wanted just to sit there like a dutiful wife and let everybody see how happy they were together. Little did she know how, very soon now, she would be bullied and terrorized, whether Innocenti was picked up here or got clean away and remained over there. When she had thought of nothing but herself, when she had been insensitive and domineering, eager to crush him, to force her own shoddy values on him, Innocenti had thought, very well, let her suffer, let her learn her lesson, it will do her good. But this was the old, the gentle Dottie, and he was acutely sorry for her. He had been unfair. He felt more painfully ill at ease, unhappier from one moment to the next. It was high time for him to leave this stupid party, if only he could be sure that worse did not await him at home. Clara emerged from the half-darkened smaller room after a perfunctory attempt to adjust an erratic television set for the benefit of would-be viewers. She stood in the doorway, amazed to see Innocenti and Dutnara sitting so close and contentedly together, and realized, not for the first time, that every marriage has unfathomable secrets best not disturbed. The party had really been arranged for her, but she had not enjoyed it one little bit. Indeed, she had found it painful and depressing. She had rushed around, making people welcome and trying to keep them happy, but her heart was not in it. Nothing amused her. None of the guests interested her. And the new dress, green crepe satin with brighter insets in the collar and the bodice and at the wrists, probably did no more for her than all her others. She had allowed a new acquaintance, the square-headed critic, to be wished on her, but their exchanges had been cool, artificial, and somehow unnatural. He had sat on the sofa for half an hour, argued about nothing with Dinera for another half hour, then started drinking with the other old soldiers. Clara felt no urge to latch on to him and lure him or drag him away. But she would not have many more chances. She would not be in bloom much longer. If she missed her chance now, she could expect something older and worse, or nothing at all. Had it been only that morning, right there in Moscow? That thrilling conversation, the blue-eyed boy's ecstatic look, the soul-shaking kiss, and her solemn promise to wait. Was it only today that she had spent 3 hours braiding a basket for a New Year's tree? It could not have been on planet Earth. It could not have been in the flesh. Nothing like it had happened in a quarter of a century. She must have dreamed it.